9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring today. Robert Half is here to help. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
President Biden will head to Israel, pledging solidarity with America's ally and humanitarian support for Palestinians. We'll get an update on the situation in Gaza.
We interviewed people who told us they were standing for hours just to buy bread and literally looking at like the last bottles of water that they had left in their home.
Plus, China's Belt and Road Initiative turns 10 as Beijing rebrands its global infrastructure plan. It's Tuesday, October 17th. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. President Biden is due to leave the White House this evening for Israel amid concerns about a wider conflict and a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made the announcement as he wrapped up his six-day tour of the Middle East.
On Wednesday, President Biden will visit Israel. He's coming here at a critical moment for Israel, for the region, and for the world.
Opening the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt will be a key focus for Biden, with efforts to let through Americans and other Western nationals stalling yesterday after a blast hit a parking lot near the border. Egypt is concerned that Israel won't pause airstrikes, while Israel has said it is worried that Hamas and Islamic Jihad are smuggling arms through the border, but insists it won't target civilian convoys. Yet there are signs of a potential breakthrough, with the U.S. and Israel due to hammer out details on how to get aid into Gaza again, a key demand for Arab nations.
The United States and Israel have agreed to develop a plan that will enable humanitarian aid from donor nations and multilateral organizations to reach civilians in Gaza, and them alone, including the possibility of creating areas to help keep civilians out of harm's way. It is critical that aid begin flowing into Gaza as soon as possible.
That comes as the UN Security Council last night voted down a Russian resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. America's UN ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield made it clear that the resolution's lack of a mention of Hamas made it a non-starter for the U.S.
The bottom line is this. You cannot claim to stand with the Palestinians and their legitimate aspirations if you do not stand squarely against Hamas.
Speaking after the vote, Russia's UN ambassador Vasily Nebenzia criticized Western countries who blocked the resolution.
We are deeply disappointed with the results of the voting. There is nothing in the resolution that can be contested because it's purely a humanitarian one. And the only reason why the resolution didn't pass was because they didn't want to support anything coming from Russia.
From the Security Council in New York, let's now get an update on the situation in Gaza, where more than 500,000 Palestinians have heeded Israeli warnings to leave the northern portion of the enclave ahead of a potential Israeli ground invasion. Those who left behind their homes in the north have found relative safety in the south, where Israeli bombings are less frequent, but they are now contending with a lack of critical supplies, including drinking water and food. Journal correspondent Chow Dang is in Cairo. Chow, give us the latest on the forced evacuation that's still underway in Gaza, and which, according to your reporting, is worsening what was already a humanitarian crisis there.
So according to Israeli estimates, roughly 600,000 people in northern Gaza have now moved south. So you can imagine that southern Gaza is becoming more dense than what it already was. And as people crowd into homes there and hospitals, shelters and schools, they are struggling to find food, water, electricity. We interviewed people who told us they were standing for hours just to buy bread and literally looking at like the last bottles of water that they had left in their home.
And when we talk about people fleeing northern Gaza for relative safety in the south, obviously relative safety very important, though the distances at play here between what's safe and what isn't are minimal.
Right. It's only a couple of miles to get from the north to the south. So it's a few minutes drive if you don't have traffic. But obviously, it's very challenging. The roads are full with rubble. Some of the roads are broken. People are worried about getting struck by bombs along the way. And once they get to the south, there's no guarantee that they are safe there. We interviewed residents in central Gaza who decided just to stay put. There was just no other place that they could live and sleep. We interviewed a mother who has twin girls and was continuing to worry about the airstrike. She had moved from her fourth floor apartment down to the first floor to her mother-in-law's home, which she thought might be a bit safer, but there's no guarantees.
Chow, over the last few days, a lot of attention has been paid to efforts to get people out of Gaza, less so, though, to what is being allowed into the territory, which we should note is dependent on imports of supplies, particularly food. Is anything going into Gaza at present?
Not much. The Israeli side has made it very clear that they want to cut off critical supplies to Gaza. The Israeli energy minister said at one point that they would turn the water back on to southern Gaza. But according to residents that we interviewed there, the taps still weren't really running. There's a long line of aid trucks outside the border crossing with Egypt. Basically, humanitarian groups hoping to get supplies in the next few days. But it's a big hope.
To clarify, you report that there are nearly 400,000 people now sheltering in United Nations schools and buildings across Gaza. The UN does have food stockpiles around the world, but is it the case that they too are reliant on those border crossings to get things in? They basically need them to open if they are to provide to people under their care?
Yes, they absolutely are. UN isn't an exception. They're saying that they also are running out of water and are also dealing with a lack of electricity, and they are not able to do their jobs properly. Yesterday, we interviewed a man in southern Gaza who had actually abandoned his home to go to one of these UN shelters at a school, and then he returned home after 2 days because he said that even the situation at this UN shelter was unsustainable.
So what's the way forward here, Chow? Are there any signals as to what could happen next? Obviously, a sense of growing urgency, UN consensus remaining elusive, though maybe a way forward, given Secretary of State Blinken's comments last night, other glimmers of hope?
I think in the immediate term, people are looking at this Rafah border crossing with Egypt as a way to get humanitarian aid in and for at least foreigners to come out of Gaza first and possibly Palestinians in the medium or longer term. You have President Biden set to visit Tel Aviv on Wednesday, and the expectation is that he will want to make some kind of deal, and perhaps that will involve an evacuation of Americans.
That was Journal correspondent Chow Deng in Cairo. Chow, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, China rolls out the red carpet for Russian President Vladimir Putin at its Belt and Road Summit. Plus, Jim Jordan strengthens his chances in the House Speaker race. That and more after the break.
Support comes from ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. You've heard the big hype around AI. The truth is, AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow is the platform that puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, and providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/AI for people to learn more.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has landed in Beijing in a show of support for China's Belt and Road Forum. Beijing is looking to reboot the Belt and Road Initiative by making its sprawling infrastructure program a lot less risky for the countries hoping to engage with China. My colleague Kate Bullivant spoke to our Asia economics reporter Jason Douglas about the BRI and its significance.
BRI is primarily aimed at the developing world and the countries that really need infrastructure. One of its driving forces is economic development. One of the big ways it thinks about this is that this is presenting a Chinese alternative to the Western model of economic development and the Western model of financing all these things through the World Bank and those sort of institutions.
And yet, the Belt and Road Initiative has faced some challenges over the past decade, right, Jason?
There's two types of challenges, really. One is financial and one is reputational. On the financial side, the lending has got a lot more risky. So lots of countries got into debt troubles over the past few years with the pandemic and then again with rising interest rates. And so lots of these Chinese loans to fund all this infrastructure spending have gone bad. And Beijing and its banks have spent quite a bit of time the last couple of years effectively bailing out some of these countries by giving them extra loans, rolling things over, even sometimes using its central bank to funnel some foreign exchange reserves towards some of these indebted governments. On the reputational side, there have been some instances where the public perception of BRI has really taken a hit. There's this idea floating around that what China's engaged in is debt trap diplomacy, where you get countries so heavily indebted to you that then they just have to hand over the assets. China, of course, denies this, and it insists it's involved in economic development and isn't engaged in that kind of thing.
So some financial and reputational challenges here for China. How is this reboot going to help resolve these problems?
China is doing a few things to improve the perception of BRI. One thing we touched on a little bit earlier is it's trying to make its own lending a little bit less risky. They're often teaming up with Western lenders who have a bit more experience managing the risks around this type of lending. Projects are getting a little bit smaller, so we're not necessarily expecting these enormous mega projects that we've had in the past. They're looking into a much broader range of areas as well. So there's a lot of talk about green energy, lots about healthcare. The State Council, which is China's cabinet, even published a document recently that listed all sorts of things that could be included in BRI, like arts and theatre and culture. So they're trying to make it a lot more understandable, a lot more friendly, and maybe not quite so overambitious as it has been previously.
And what is the significance of Vladimir Putin attending the Belt and Road Forum? It's his first foreign trip since the Ukraine war began.
I think it says relations between Russia and China are pretty good, right? They have talked very recently about this sort of no limits partnership, is how they like to put it. From Beijing's perspective, Moscow is, you know, its closest ally in this sort of emerging order that it wants to see, where Western powers aren't quite so prominent as they are at the moment. The US has been trying to persuade Beijing that maybe being quite so close to Putin isn't necessarily the right thing to do. And it appears that those efforts have kind of come to naught. They are certainly putting on a very public show of solidarity and comradeship.
That was Journal reporter Jason Douglas speaking to my colleague, Kate Bullivant. We have got developments in the race to be the next U.S. House Speaker after Republican hopeful Jim Jordan gained support from key holdouts yesterday, strengthening his chances of winning a vote of the full House that is expected this afternoon. Journal reporter Christina Peterson says that Jordan has now won over several skeptical colleagues who had earlier been critical of his approach on spending and military policy, raising hopes of a speedy resolution to the speaker fight.
There's still a handful of holdouts that he will need to win over. Most people think that he will get there, but there could be a couple more twists and turns along the way. There's also a weariness setting in the Capitol, and Republicans feel like this has been a public spectacle, and there's a real sense that they just need to pick a speaker and be able to have a functional house again.
British engine maker Rolls-Royce, the pioneer of the commercial jet engine, is shedding as many as 2,500 jobs as part of a broader push to make it more agile. That follows a management shakeup earlier this year that saw the company slash spending and renegotiate contracts. At the time, CEO Tufan Erginbilgic said that Rolls-Royce faced a last chance to save itself from being broken up or taken over. Rolls-Royce powers close to half of the world's biggest airliners, but has struggled to exit a decade-long crisis. And we'll get an update from another corner of the aviation sector today when United Airlines reports its quarterly earnings. Goldman Sachs and Bank of America will also report results. And according to a new ranking of the world's retirement systems, the United States has scored a C+, with Social Security and 401k plans leaving Americans less secure when compared to retirees in much of the world. The latest Mercer CFA Institute Global Pension Index shows the U.S. placing 22nd out of 47 countries and falling behind the Netherlands, Australia, and Sweden. And that is What's News for Tuesday morning. Today's show was produced by Kate Bullivant and Mohsen Ali. Our supervising producer is Sandra Kilhoff, and I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. We will be back tonight with a new show. Until then, thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.